Hello.
Hello.
How are you today, Stan?
Hey, just struggling with the mute button. Good. How are you, Nathan?
Doing well.
So today it looks like neither Ram nor Mick will be able to join, so they asked me to kind of guide the meeting, although I have a feeling we're going to have a very low turnout.
Okay.
So, must be the heat of the vacation season and other trouble. So, let's.
Well, I
Let's see
see
if
the comments over in Rocket Chat. It looks like it's like Vipin will be around and Mick will be around.
this was for the last Friday's confidentiality meeting.
Ah,
Yeah.
okay, yeah, that was the 13th. Yeah.
was a good call.
I'm always sorry when I miss those. Looks like we have a few more that have joined. Ben, looks like Ben
Oh, yeah.
might, audio might not be on yet.
Yeah. Oh, I've been. Hello, Ben. And some other folks. Let's give it a few more minutes.
Hi there.
Hi, Jim.
Let's see. Let me. Repost the links. See. Meeting notes. I'll be posting a few links to the Rocket Chat. So Ram will not be able to join the meeting. He's traveling and Mick is on vacation. So probably try to go over the same papers that we've been working on so far, just for the identity and interoperability seems to be good discussion topics. And then enter. Okay, there go. Got heart and weapon. Okay, great. So let's kick it off then. All right, so let's start with the reminder for the antitrust policy. And I can read that in again in the de in detail at the top of the meeting notes. So for today's agenda, I think we can look again at the system identity paper. We're almost wrapped that up, and so I think it just will take a little push to get this to completion and spend the rest of the time discussing the interoperability document. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Righty. So then let's take a look at the identity paper, the link that Nathan posted. Yep. And so first half of the paper is in really good shape, I think. And then just a few sections towards the bottom that are kind of a Nathan have been, oh, thanks. Thank you, Nathan. Been volunteered and volunteered himself for the remaining sections that mostly have to do with external system interfacing. So
I apologize if I'm going to overlap on some of what was already said a couple of weeks ago, but at the Amsterdam Hackfest, we went through and we finished out the privacy section. We did a lot on the interoperable identifier section, but not as much as we would have liked. And then we ended off at the exposing identity to external systems pieces here that I've been volunteered to work through. So I still have that assignment. We're looking for a volunteer for consuming identity from external systems, in particular, someone who's familiar with the approach that Fabric has taken on consuming identities from LDAP or from a certificate authority, and what trust guarantees are required to make that work. Would be helpful to have someone fill that section in. I don't know if we have a volunteer who can take that.
I can do
that. Yeah, I was going to say, I can also look at that because I actually have that need in the short term. So yeah. I'm tracking what Fabric's trying to do in providing that. So I'd be happy to look at that as well. That's Jim.
Jim, all right. I'm going to put you down for that section. And then we get into the specific solutions for the different frameworks and how each framework handles the architecture for their system identities. I don't expect that any of these sections will be very long, but that could vary. I think Fabric might have a lot to say about the specifics of their implementation. They have a lot of interfaces there, whereas something like Indy might not have as much to say because it's most of the identity system for Indy is handled in the layer above, and then the system identity layer leverages the layer above. Do we have any idea who could volunteer for each of these frameworks or who we should go ask to volunteer?
Typically in this work group, we have the architecture representation. I don't know if Ben can reach out to someone or should we?
Yeah. I think you can put my name on Fabric. There are tons of documents out there that either I can filter through and extract out here or I ask someone to help.
Great, thank you. And then we'll probably need the mix feedback for Sawtooth, and had some trouble reaching out to Iroha. So maybe I can ping Makoto to see if someone will be able to help out. The same for Burrow. All right.
Okay, and then it looks like Amit volunteered for the summary paragraph at the end. I don't know if Amit's on the call today. Okay, and please do add your name to the table here at the bottom so you've added content. We can go through and work on some of these sections collaboratively, but I think usually it's best to get people a chance to put some initial content in first, and then the review goes much faster that way.
Agreed.
Does anyone have any questions on kind of the work that was done on this paper at the Amsterdam Hackfest?
So
yes, Nathan.
Go ahead.
I'm curious about what exactly was done. This is Vipin, of course, and I hadn't had an opportunity to log in, to call in last time when you guys met again after the hackfest, I guess.
Yeah, and I apologize. I missed that call, so I don't know what was already discussed then. But essentially what we did is there's another paper that I pointed people to. If you look at, let's see if I can find that. No, it wasn't that one. This is a document that came out of the ZK Proof conference where we worked through some of the identity positioning from the applications track at that conference. There were a few items that I pointed out.
Okay, obviously.
To that track that were, and we talked about what was in scope and what was not in scope for the Hyperledger document, and then, or for the architecture working group's document. And then we dove into the architecture's working group document and we went through, I believe we picked it up in the privacy section, and we did kind of the classic collaborative writing that we've done at some of the hackfests in the past. And we worked through what was left of the privacy paragraphs and the interoperable identifier paragraph. There were actually two other paragraphs we collapsed into the privacy paragraph as part of writing the privacy paragraph. And that's the bulk of what happened. There was a lot of bringing people up to speed. There were three or four new folks that were eager to help and contribute, especially the architecture working group. Hart and I tried to bring them up to speed on what had been going on in the group and kind of what the thoughts were on what system identity means relative to what's going on at the identity working group, where I hope some of them have also started to attend the calls.
Sounds good, Nathan. Thank you. As you know, we were together in that applications track on the ZK proofs. I'll take another look at this because I'm really interested in how this process will also affect the identity working group paper, which is not just the process, but the actual content.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot more content in the ZK proof track that affects the identity paper than affects the system entity paper. One of the conversations we spent some time on is how, for a permission chain, knowing who's running which nodes and knowing the properties of the nodes can be very important to the system identities and the trust in the system identities. So I think that the ZK proof paper will be much more helpful to the identity track than it is to this particular paper.
This is great. All right. So, So did you guys go over the paper, and did you identify any additional sections, or this has been pretty much, does this look like this will be the final structure for this paper?
We did go over the fact that we need sections to describe kind of how each framework handles the items described above.
Yeah.
And those were sections that weren't in the paper before. I think this is essentially the final structure of the paper in terms of which paragraphs we have and what items we're trying to address. If there are comments or feedback on that, it would be good to go add those as comments to the paper now so that we can make sure that we have the right assignments made to finish up the core structure.
Yeah, sounds great. The paper looks to be in much better shape before after the work at the Hackfest. That's good. All right, so I guess if there are no other comments or suggestions for the identity paper, we can maybe talk about interoperability. Doc, how does that sound?
That sounds good to me.
All right. So I think I posted the link in the Rocket Chat. Let's see. So I have not had a chance to work on this document a lot, but I guess it's clearly missing the same structure that we've been, similar level of structure that's been outlined so far. So it'd be really great to hear people's feedback. And I know that there's been, so I don't know, actually I was gonna ask Vipin, given that the paper that you wrote on interoperability, that note, do you have some feedback comments over this structure, and overall we feel that there's things that are missing from describe the interoperability as a problem? I know there's nothing about actual solutions, but as far as describing the problem and high-level approach to solving it, do you feel there's maybe aspects that are missing?
I just did take a brief glance at it earlier, when you had first started working on it, but I haven't, mm-hmm. I must confess that I haven't taken a look at it lately. Mm-hmm. But I will, and if I have something to suggest, I'll do so. Are you focused purely on the enterprise, or are you going to use, are you going to also say something about using more publicly available chains to do the identity pivoting and those kind of things that underlie interoperability, or semi-public chains like Indy, I guess.
Well, I think we'll, given the audience and the kind of the goals of this paper to represent the Hyperledger projects, I think we'll only be bringing up public or semi-public networks in the context where it relates to the current projects. So Indy being one of the better examples given the existence of Sovereign. As far as the others, I don't think that we'll be talking about, we should probably talk about the sidechains as a as a mention, right? Because they did have an approach to solving the interoperability problem, but it's as a particular solution, it may not necessarily be relevant to how Hyperledger, current Hyperledger projects are dealing with it.
Well, we do have to at least address this idea of pivoting meaning from one chain to another, because if you make it so that all transactions have to be completely interoperable across chains, you actually lose your competitive advantage of why Sawtooth is the way it is versus why Fabric is the way it is. Yeah. So we need to talk about both the pivoting of the keys, meaning what a particular key and the ownership of that key means. And then we also need to talk about the pivoting of meaning of pieces of state or pieces of schema that are on a ledger, right? Because one ledger can understand that schema much differently than another ledger, and there still can be interoperability between the two as long as the scope of transactions on one ledger is within the scope of meaning on that ledger, and the scope of meaning in the other ledger is within the scope of transactions on that other ledger.
Well, in this context, you know, usually this kind of interoperability in current systems have been achieved by use of canonical standards that everybody transforms their schemas, semantics, various things into some canonical form. They write two adapters, one to put stuff into this canonical form, one to get stuff from the canonical form. And once you do that and you have some kind of canonical form, then having those two types of interactions will provide, you know, opportunities for expansion in the future, whatever it is. But in terms of the, like you have said before, Nathan, blockchains or DLTs are a different animal in certain senses. So just having data interoperability will not be enough. It'll require more how those security guarantees and other properties of the system translate into this canonical form. It's going to be a slightly different there, I think.
So can I ask a question? Because when I looked at the Quilt project, right, they talk about interoperability over there, but the reality is they're only focused, their context is pretty small. They're talking about basically, I'll call it atomic currency swaps. You know, that's their initial target, which is very, very small, very limited. When you look at smart contracts, and, you know, in anybody's case, you can say I have a contract that is doing, performing X operations, and it needs to, in a sense, use or invoke operations on a different contract somewhere else. So you have to, in a sense, go through a whole life cycle of, in a sense, discovery, understanding the metadata, mapping. It's not just, you know, and I think you're right. Part of, you already laid out the concept that you have to have some sort of metadata exchange model, canonical form to do a get and a put and so on. But actually being able to, in a sense, discover, understand, bind, and execute, and then even roll back transactions at a high level that are not these, what I call trivial things, like atomic swaps, you know, for real transactions, is a pretty broad challenge, I should say. And it does go, it steps outside of just the canonical description of how we describe a service and how you're going to invoke it and so on, you know, as a contract. There's a lot to that, to automate that, if you will.
Yeah, no doubt.
And the other thing I would also throw out just as a thought is you can look at any blockchain and say, okay, it's got a smart contract, there's a way to update it and provide information about it, which is fine. But the notion of worrying about how can I get data from a chain outside of the context of just transactions, there's lots of ways that any blockchain should quote, choose to publish data, if you will, and make it available and consumable outside of the scope of just, you know, call it an interoperable transaction. But I think you're hitting all the key points here. The problem, I think, that I don't see listed here is what I call the mapping. So if you have, in fact, if we follow that logic that there has to be a common interchange format, you know, for the requests and the responses and so on, that's understood and that maps to contracts. If you're going to go that way, then you have to talk about how do you map from the common request response format, you know, into what the client is going to, how the client's going to adapt to that, how the server, in a sense, provider is going to adapt to that as well.
Yeah, and I think this gets to one of the important constructs in a smart contract-based system is that usually interoperability formats are thought more like about more like serialization formats for exchange between systems, whereas when you're doing a decentralized system for smart contracts, you're actually embodying the meaning of the state and what transitions are valid in the chain itself. So you actually centralize the meaning on the blockchain. And when you start talking about one chain talking to another chain, you have to make that transition back to kind of a serialization format where you're messaging or you're communicating to a different external system what's going on. And you can't rely on the state transition guarantees surviving those boundaries. And so how you decentralize that and how you negotiate what what data is serialized and what the other system can or cannot do with that data when they present it back to your system is important.
Well, actually, so yeah, you bring up a huge point, because anytime you use the word transaction, you also have to talk about the word commitment boundary or scope, transaction scope as well. And so that has to go in there. And then you're right, you have to define. There's going to be things that are not like a logging service where you don't really care if you drop some, you know, items. They're not critical, as opposed to a payment exchange where you can drop nothing. So you have to determine, you know, is this a commitment, you know, is transaction commitment required here or not? You know, that's obviously an option for a transaction.
Well, and if we look at the parallel of operating systems, there's a lot of transaction integrity that can be accomplished without knowing the meaning of the data at all. So I think the other thing that's going to start happening is we're going to start seeing not smart contract based systems, but I think like global mutex style systems, where if we can do the double spend proofing on the ledger in an unambiguous way, the meaning of the data itself might not be housed on the ledger at all. And so
actually, that's absolutely 100% right, because you're going to have a lot of transactions that fit that profile for sure, because you're going to say the meaning is going to show up, quote, later on by somebody else that's going to consume from the blockchain what that item was, and they'll determine the meaning at that point.
Right, or the meaning will be disclosed after the fact using
right
whatever proofs can be presented during the auditing phase.
Yep, absolutely. And you're right, that's probably going to be the bulk of the transactions, I would imagine.
So what I think that means in terms of the paper is we have to be able to talk about how that meaning is proven and communicated. Just like the proof of who's who on a ledger turns out to be quite complicated, the proof of what things mean and who's in charge of what they mean turns out to be even more so, because a lot of these, a lot of the specifics of how you deal with what data means varies so much between different systems. For instance, if you think about how Corda handles schema and who agrees to the state change on a particular transaction versus how that might be handled, say, in Ethereum. There's a lot of subtleties in which keys are signing which parts and why does the ledger accept that transition of state, or why do the parties who are specifically involved in that transaction accept the transition of state?
Yeah. And so with that, if you look at those steps you're talking about, then the challenge is kind of like HTTP, you wind up with this life cycle and you have a series of events at different stages in the life cycle that in a sense may not be met properly for the transaction use case you define. So if you say, okay, my transaction use case is this one, I require commitment control, but the meaning, if you will, is not going to be disclosed, if you will, initially when the transaction occurs, but at some later point, if you say that's a use case, boom, okay, then there's a series of events that would occur on the failure side to complete those policies that need to show up in a model. And so I would argue, and this is where I'm looking at all these frameworks and not seeing much, is we really should have something equivalent from I'll call it a life cycle management on what I call failure, much like HTTP. You have all those different, what I call reason codes that show up. Here's a 200 level there, a 400 and so on. And it makes automated management and response to problems or issues possible, because you've identified that stuff, you've categorized it well. If you don't do that, like most of what I see over in the frameworks I'm looking at, then you're left with leaving it to programmers rather than automated systems to manage events, which isn't a good thing. Exception events, I should say. So I would argue that there's an error management protocol that should go along with whatever is proposed, or exception management.
So it leaves us in a situation where we have to almost enumerate everything, where I think what's possible to enumerate may not still even be bounded. But you can think about this specifically when you start talking about pivoting on identities. I can accept things that are signed by an external system so long as I can resolve the DIDs or foreign keys for those identifiers. You know, if I can validate the cryptographic proofs that came from the external system, I should be able to accept the correct signed state from that system at a point in time, but only provided I can resolve to their root of trust. So I might have resolution errors on the identifiers are not resolvable. I might have identifiers on the chain that those identifiers are anchored to is not resolvable.
Right. And I'm just arguing that I would like to see error categories for those things. We're never going to, as you say, enumerate all the specific errors we're going to get. But if we have categories, then that at least gives us the ability to start handling categories of problems.
I'm hoping someone who's working on a transactional smart contract-based system can weigh in here, because the system that we're building for Indy has the double spend proofing approach and some other things that are interesting to this, but Indy doesn't really approach this as a traditional smart contract storage of state problem. So Ben or partner or Vipin, do you have thoughts on this?
This has been, it's very different in Fabric because it's an optimistic system. So transaction, the state of the transaction is built up before the actual ordering of the transaction. So what we end up is a set of read and write variables. And then at the time that we commit the transaction, we would check what we call MVCC violation. We would check the version of the keys to see if they are the same as the time that we read the keys or we write the keys. So that's how we detect for any kind of collision. And certainly double spending is one of that case.
So in this...
And it's not managed by the smart contract. It's managed by the system.
Yeah, so in this sense, though, wouldn't any piece of information required for the transaction have to be anchored or stored as state on the chain?
The data is part of when we submit the transaction, the read and write set is part of that transaction. So imagine like a UTXO transaction where the set of inputs and outputs are part of that transaction. So the read write set is similar to that.
Okay, so anything that would affect the validation of the transaction is either a parameter to the transaction or the state being operated on by the transaction. So what we're saying is if you were to operate on any external state, the parameters that are passed into the transaction have to be sufficient to validate everything that needs to be validated for that transaction to operate on data that's external to a fabric chain. Is that right?
That may be overreaching it a little bit, I'm guessing, the way you put it, because I think what you're concerned about is what's getting stored on the chain has to be validated. But something outside of that, if I have a key to something, like an order number key, the order number is valid, but I'm not validating the order itself. I'm just validating the identity of the order, if you will. That's part of what's going on the chain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I'm trying to get the feel for how much data has to be translated to become native to the chain before it's useful. For example, so if we had a sawtooth chain and a fabric chain side by side, and if you want to use have a transaction that leverages some information in the sawtooth chain, how would you go about that?
Right. So you're going to have to know what the transaction is you're trying to invoke, what the contract is. Obviously, you have to know that. You have to know what you're required as input to whatever that transaction is, whether it's a get or a put from Sawtooth Chain. And you have to understand what your response is going to be back and what the exceptions coming back can be. And you have to know for the response that you do expect back, in a sense, how to map that into, in a sense, your state, whatever that's going to be. So there's a lot of things you have to know, forgetting the complexity of actually doing it. There's a lot you have to know about what you're trying to do ahead of time, obviously. That has to be defined somewhere.
Just to step back a little bit.
The way that is all covered.
Yeah, I'm sure, Stan, you've covered a lot of the stuff. I think we need to step back a little bit. You know, the richness and the complexity of individual chains are never going to be completely interoperable. There has to be a limit, you know, limitation on what exactly will interoperate, not, you know. So there has to be a, you know, we can't have an abstraction that encompasses all the different types of complexity arising from a single chain, like a fabric, you know, particular smart contract and transaction, to anything on the other side, like a sawtooth chain. It has to be, like, you know, that's why I think a study of the L2 systems, like we have talked about before, might help us, because they have, you know, like, or ILP, which is basically based on, you know, some kind of a locking mechanism and then transferring value. So, you know, instead of... So we have to look at the components and then say, okay, what of these can be transported, or what of these are very specific to the chain and cannot be. So in that sense, you know, limit the you know, the kind of interoperability that can be achieved.
Your point, I think, on the fact that we shouldn't assume we should attempt to cover, in a sense, any type of transaction makes sense. Let me ask a question to the group. Does it make sense to start out with very concrete use cases that we would define? And I can easily think of, like, we have the double spend problem. There's a commitment control problem. You're trying to synchronize two systems. That's one. But if we had a short list of what we consider to be use cases in scope, the one I'm thinking of that I'm actually going to be using on our blockchains is what I call just a simple logging use case. It's not transaction critical. You're trying to build up data, in a sense, accumulate data for analytic purposes. And if you dropped 5% of the transactions, none of them are critical. You know what I mean? That's a different use case. And so I'm looking to find use cases that the group would think should be in scope beyond just the double spend problem.
That may be a good way to tease out all the different aspects of what's involved. I guess what's in there now, right, is focused too much on the low-level details versus the kind of the end result. So the use case would let us focus really on the goals, like why are we talking about this, and how do we expect this to look? So as far as logging, what do you see as being, what are the two systems that are interacting? Is it the system that produces the logs and then
in my case, I'm looking at Fabric and saying, okay, I've got to create some blockchains. And the purpose of my blockchains initially is only to provide logging for statistical analysis, if you will, to some business applications that are already running. So I'm adding, if you will, my immutable ledger, if you will, as a log service that gets plugged onto existing transaction systems, and then they get written off to the blockchain and say, there you go, now you got a permanent log of those transactions, and that's it. So it is that, what I call, very simple, very lightweight logging use case. There's nothing more complex in my mind than that. And yet, we will also have transactions we need to execute that fit the double spend problem as well. That's another use case. So I'm looking at those two use cases and saying, okay, a third use case actually is just querying data, and that's it. So again, if I have a compliance or a governance need or whatever, I'm going to say, well, this blockchain supports these queries, and that's it. And you can ask these questions about it. You know, you can say, here's the transactions by period for this user, you know, whatever it is, those kind of things. So we'll have a, what I call a query use case, where we have defined queries. And those are really just the three use cases that I'm looking at for what we're trying to do.
I guess I was thinking in terms of the, what is the other direction. So in case of logging, it's really one way communication. And in case of the transaction double spend, it's more of the exception. So you would get back the feedback that this is a double spend or it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And then the query is the other direction. What I was kind of trying to say earlier that this, in the context of what was there as a structure, that we talked about these, some of these topics in terms of externalizing the state. And so the one aspect that I just kind of added scaffolding there that we didn't talk about and that you brought up, which is obviously the other side of it. How do you consume and interpret this externalized state? What are the, how do you define what can be externalized? And what are the guarantees that are coming with it? And that would be probably heavily state use case dependent.
Well, I was going to say, the one thing you just brought up though about consuming external state, you said, what are the guarantees? That to me correctly defines that on a request, there should be options on what you are looking for as guarantees.
Well, and this gets to a couple of interesting cases. One of them is the idea of cross-anchoring, meaning in order to trust the state of your ledger, I need to know something about who I'm trusting or what I'm trusting in terms of the system identities or in terms of the trust guarantees of your ledger. Yeah. So we can talk about cross-anchoring, like if I understand what the current block height and hashes of are of Ethereum and Bitcoin on my ledger, I can use my ledger state to validate things that come from Bitcoin and Ethereum and vice versa, because I'm after proof of before and proof of after that I need to have anchoring my information on their chain and their information on my chain. And then the other one that we haven't really touched on a lot, but we did talk about a little bit in terms of balance transfer, is the one asset transfer between systems. And I think we already actually have some pretty good expertise and familiarity with that in terms of channels on Fabric, where when you transfer an asset from one channel to another, you have some mechanism for saying that it's locked in all the other channels. And we have a similar need when we start talking about, you know, transferring an asset from one system to another and knowing that the state of the asset on the other ledgers is still locked.
Yes, perfect. I agree with you. This concept of, you call it a balance transfer use case, which is fine. You're absolutely requiring hard locks on assets, if you will, during the execution of the transaction until it's completed. There's, in effect, that's a simple way to solve that problem.
Well, and you know, maybe an example here is a car repair. You might have locked the asset vehicle on the other chain, but then, you know, the auto mechanics ledger, you've actually disassembled the car and started repairing and replacing parts. And so the semantics of what constitutes a vehicle on the, you know, the auditing for repairs chain might be very different than on, say, the DMV's chain. And that's part of what we're trying to talk about when we talk about pivoting meaning, is that, you know, for example, airplane parts and maintenance, some chains might have to be very aware about all the individual components, whereas another might be able to treat the logical whole in aggregate.
It's to your point, you're right. So in that case, we have an instance of an object that has an identity, in this case, a VIN number. And one chain only needs to know maybe what the wholesale value of the VIN is, along with the VIN and maybe its physical location. And the other chain that you're talking about, you're right, has all of the components of that, you know, parts, serial numbers, and everything else. But you're right, the linkage between the two is the single common identity there to identify the asset on both chains, which makes sense. And I actually have a use case. I have a parts use case too for vehicles, but my more immediate one is actually rentals, which gets into the locking situation you brought up, which is an example where you're going to rent a vehicle and you're looking at a catalog of vehicles, and I'm looking at the same catalog you're looking at, possibly we're in the same location, physically, say in whatever, the state of New York or something, and we're both looking at these vehicles that are available, and you go to select one. Until you actually decide to rent one and click the I want to rent this button, that vehicle is still available to me. So whoever gets in there first is going to have what I call the ability to rent that vehicle, which is a normal thing. The problem is once you click and say, I want to rent it, at that point, it becomes like a seat at a concert that you're trying to buy tickets for, where we're going to give you a limited amount of time to say, okay, you can complete what I call the payment cycle for that rental within this period. And if you fail to complete within that period, we'll, in a sense, cancel and release your transaction back, you know, into the marketplace. So we'll be absolutely doing that locking concept that you mentioned to lock a transaction for a period of time and reserve it, if you will, to a single user.
Well, and this gets back to the transaction privacy as well, because you may not want to disclose all the details of what's locked, but you do want to make sure that it's double spend proofed.
You're correct. We got both of those there. That's right.
That's great. So could I maybe ask folks to like volunteer to fill out some of the sections, or maybe add a topic that they feel is worth? Again, we're just early on in this paper. I'm sure we'll reorganize it a few times, but we just added a pivoting section, which is obviously one of the cornerstones. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you want, we did discuss use cases. If you want, I could start, what I call kick off a section just on use cases. That's what I call lightweight, and then let everybody else sort of fix it and improve it.
I think that would be great.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. So I was going to say, ask Nathan maybe to pitch in on the pivoting aspect of it. Going. Hey, Nathan, can I volunteer you again?
You can always try.
Nice. So I'm going to try to volunteer you to maybe not even fill out, but outline the pivoting aspect. That's, I guess, in a way, we've already done. But if you think that there are other kind of a topic, like facets of this that we should cover, it would be great to just create this structure for the group to work on. Great. Anonymous in theater. All right, and I've added the use case section at the bottom. So Jim can pick that up. And exception management as well, as you brought it up. I feel that is somewhat related to the externalizing the state in both aspects, like producing and consuming, but it is a kind of a higher level aspect of it, so it's definitely worth discussion.
Yeah, that's fine. I can throw something in there. Yeah, start.
Right, thanks. Yeah, I think that's this early on, this is exactly what we need, just the scaffolding first, discussion points. Thank you. So as far as the, I know Quilt and Interledger Protocol has been brought up several times. How do you guys feel this fits into this paper as a specific implementation of interoperability, or it could be used as a kind of framework of how to look at it?
For me, when I looked at Quilt, and this is wrong, I haven't spent enough time understanding it, but when I look over there and look at what they've done, all I'm seeing their focus on is the concept of an atomic currency swap. You know, that's what they keep referring to in their examples, and that I don't see any other use case defined over there. And I see this team talking about what I call some very broad, powerful, much bigger scope concepts of interoperability than just a simple atomic swap of an asset.
I think it's important we talk about it as a use case and as an implementation. I think it should be mentioned in both of those contexts here.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right about the use case, but it's one of our list of use cases that we're listing.
Yeah, I think Nathan's right. I was curious, do we really want to spend a lot of time talking about component interoperability?
Probably not.
Because this is just like, this is a little bit different than what we're talking about, right? Most of interoperability is kind of on the application layer and on the surface. And component interoperability might be how that works. Certainly if your components are interoperable, then, you know, application interoperability becomes much easier. But this seems kind of not super related to the rest of the stuff here.
I think that's a great point. I mean, if you think about it as a layer problem, at the top you have whatever application you wrote. Below that, you've had your blockchain and smart contracts. And then, yes, the blockchain itself or the contracts could be using components, but you're right, it's not related to, in a sense, the contracts and the blockchain directly. It's just a set of components. And they don't, in a sense, that same set of components, maybe a date framework, could be used up at the application layer, it could be used, you know, at the contract layer or anywhere else. But that the concept of interoperability of the components, I would agree, seems to be off topic to interoperability of blockchains and identity and so on.
There are a few cases where I think we will get into some of the interoperable components in terms of how we blind data in order to accomplish the locking or double spend proofing that's required when the actual semantic data might not be available. But that seems like more of a how, not a what.
Yes.
These papers are focused on what the guarantees need to be, not on how to accomplish them.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. I would agree with that. That's awesome.
So I guess just strike that section altogether.
We can put maybe a note on it that says we were thinking of putting this out of scope. That way, if
explicitly put it out of scope. Yeah.
This should be in the kind of the techniques, right? So there are, I assume we're going to discuss how we can achieve kind of interoperability, right? When we discuss examples. So, I mean, I think we can allude to this kind of thing here that, you know, obviously if we write modular programs and everything is the base layers are interoperable, then things just work, right? Then it's really easy. And I think that's kind of our story for this, right? Is that in our dream world, every blockchain platform is modular and, you know, all the interfaces just work even at the lower level. But we know that's not the case and that will never be the case. And that's why we kind of have to work with protocols like Interledger or Quilt or stuff like that. Does that seem reasonable?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great way to add to the scope section for sure, to target it. Nice.
left a comment in the section, kind of collapse that into a, I guess, more of a comment for the scope, for the intro, probably. Yeah. It's good. All right. Well, we're almost, sounds like we're a good stopping point. We're almost at the top of the hour. So, I want to thank everybody and say we'll wrap this up and looking forward to everyone's comments and contributions. Hopefully we can again sketch out the better structure and outline for the papers to start filling it out with content. So. All right.
Thanks, Stan. All right.
So thanks for leading me, Stan. Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.